through 29, a passage which has a lot of drama in it. And it sort of ends on a low moment, but I think it has something to say to you and I. Mark chapter 6, verse 17. For Herod himself had sent and laid hold of John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. Because John had said to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. I should just point out to you that she wasn't just his wife, she was his niece as well. King Herod the Great had 10 wives, and this isn't the Herod that chased Jesus around, chased him to Egypt. This is the son of Herod the Great. And they say if you look at the Herodian tree, it looks like a twisted vine for reasons like this. Therefore, Herodias held it against him and wanted to kill him, but she could not. For Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy man, and he protected him. And when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly. Then an opportune day came when Herod, on his birthday, gave a feast for his nobles and high officers and the chief men of Galilee. And when Herodias' daughter herself came in and danced and pleased Herod and those who sat with him, the king said to the girl, ask me whatever you want and I will give it to you. And he also swore to her, whatever you ask, I will give to you up to half the kingdom. That's an idiom, by the way. That's like saying, I'm so hungry I could eat a horse. Of course you can't. But it's a nice way of saying, I'll give you something big. Ask, maybe half the kingdom, but I won't give you half the kingdom. And it's an idiom. It's an idiom, anyway. Look up idiom. So she went out and said to her mother, what shall I ask? And she said, the head of John the Baptist. Immediately she came in and with haste to the king and asked, saying, I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter. The king was exceedingly sorry, yet because of the oaths and because of those who sat with him, he did not want to refuse her. So immediately the king sent an executioner and commanded his head to be brought, and he went and beheaded him in prison. Brought his head on a platter and gave it to the girl, and the girl gave it to her mother. And then when his disciples heard of it, they came and took away his corpse and laid it in a tomb. One of the things my wife and I like to do is we like to sit and watch murder mysteries, real murder mysteries. And the issue with the murder is usually you know who did it right off. If it was the wife, it was always the husband. They can work it out, but it was the husband who went and did the dirty deed. In fact, I've told you this before, and I'm not joking when I say this. If there's a life insurance policy on the woman, they don't even look for anybody else. So for years, I didn't have a life insurance policy on my wife for just that reason. No joke. And then one night I was sitting and I was thinking about all the people I would have to hire. If God forbid she should die, I'd have to hire a cook, at least two cleaners, and maybe even a butler. I don't know. But so I went and got a life insurance policy on her because of the cost it would take to replace her, God forbid. And so if something untimely happens to my wife, I mean, for me, it's don't collect, don't pass go, don't collect $200. I go directly to jail. And I can see myself in the back of the cop car saying, listen, fellas, I didn't even do it. They say, listen, we listened to your preaching. We heard what you said about her. She had a life insurance policy. And when we found you, you were covered with red hair. And it's like, listen, but preachers, you can't take what a preacher says seriously about his wife. And I had to hire all these people because if something like this happened, and I'm always covered with red hair. That's how she marks her territory. It wasn't me. I'm serious. She must have ticked somebody else off. It wasn't me. Murder. You sort of know who did it, but it's the why that is sort of the focus oftentimes. Why did he do it? What did she do? Why did he do it? Which buttons did she push? Now, and you have that in this case. It's pretty clear that we have a murder. It's not an execution, really. It's a murder. It's a cold-blooded murder. And we know who did it. It was Herod who did it. But the question is, why did Herod do it? What motivated him to do this gruesome deed? And when you read the account, you can't, you know, maybe it's just a guy thing, but there are noble things, I think, about Herod that are worth pointing out before you get to the gruesome issue here. The back story of this account is that Herod had gone on a trip to Rome with his wife. He'd been married about 20 years. And he went to see his brother in Rome. And while in Rome, he and his brother's wife started locking eyes. And maybe they talked on the veranda one night. And then Herod did what always gets a woman going. He said, "Hey, would you like to go out for a fish sandwich?" You know, women feel that way about Captain D's. And so they went out for a fish sandwich, and then yada, 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 they're together, and now they've both dumped their spouses, and they're going back to Jerusalem together. And when John the Baptist heard this, he did what a preacher always does. He says, "Well, I can't get involved in politics. I'll just have to keep my mouth shut." That's what he did, right? No, that's not what he did. Said, "No, this is my place. I'm going to say something about what's going on in the capital today." And so he begins to rail against this unlawful marriage between Herod and Herodias. Now, it seems to me that what John is doing here, and John doesn't say what he's doing, but I think this is what's happening. I think that Herod claimed to be a Jew. In fact, I know Herod claimed to be a Jew. Herod the Great, although he had 10 wives and killed multiple wives and killed multiple kids, they were all Edomites. They were all pagans who lived near the desert. But they intermarried with the Jews, and to rule the Jews, the family of Herod claimed to be Jews. In fact, Herod the Great helped really refurbish the temple to the degree that it was called Herod's Temple. So they claimed to be Jews because it was easier to rule the Jews. And it seems to me what John the Baptist is doing is saying, "Listen, if you want to claim to be a Jew, you have to live like a Jew. And what you did is unlawful for a Jew to do. You can't be married to your brother's wife while he's yet alive, and you broke up the marriage. All of this is very sinful. And since you are claiming to be a Jew, you need to live like a Jew." And there's something to say about how Christians ought to address our own politicians in that little situation. If they claim to be a Christian to get our votes, they ought to live like Christians. And it's not wrong for us to call them out for not doing it. And so John the Baptist calls out Herod. And it doesn't seem like Herod has that big of a beef with John the Baptist. But the wife, Herodias, does have a problem. And so she says, "I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill John the Baptist." And so John the Baptist ends up in jail. Now what's interesting here is that while he's in jail, he and Herod start to have these conversations. And you'll notice in verse 20, I think it is, that you see that Herod, first of all, says, "John's a righteous man, and I know a righteous man when I see one, although I'm not. John's just. John's righteous." And the Bible says he feared John. He didn't want him to put him to death, because if he did, he'd bring the wrath of God down on himself, which he did later on. But here, you have to admire that, I think, about Herod. He says, "This guy's a righteous man. This guy's right. This guy's on the level. This guy speaks the words of God. I can respect that. And not only that, verse 20 says that he likes or that he liked to hear him preach. You've got to admire anybody who likes to hear anybody preach, man. That says something about him. He liked to hear John preach. He said, bring him out. I want to hear what he has to say. Preach it again, John. I want to hear this. I like this. And in verse 20, it says that he had John in prison to protect him. Protect him from who? Herodias. I mean, he's got him locked up because he knows his wife wants to kill her. So here's Herod telling all his guards, now listen, when my wife comes down here, do not let her in that cell. Do not let her. She'll beat him to death with her high heel. She's crazy. She's bat crazy. I love her dearly, but don't let her near the man. And you got to admire that about Herod. And I think in that way, Herod is like a lot of people today. I mean, there are people that, you know, they love the Lord. They listen to or they love hearing about the Lord. Let me put it that way. They like to listen to gospel music. They like to go to church. They like to read books about the Bible. They can listen. I don't want to go there. They can listen to gospel singers and they're very moved emotionally. This is Herod. But the Bible says that while Herod had these feelings about John and was moved by the words of John, it says there that in verse 20, King James says, and he did many things. Some translations say he was perplexed. But there's a picture that's being drawn in that little phrase in verse 20 where it says he did many things or perplexed. What it means is that Herod couldn't make up his mind what he was going to do about the message of John. Perplexed, he was confused, he did many things, and the picture is that of a man at a crossroads who is very active. He doesn't know if he wants to go that way or that way or that way or that way. So he's moving around. He's doing many things. He's looking. I don't know about that. But he doesn't know where to go. He does many things. He's like a quarterback who doesn't know if he's going to hand the ball off or if he's going to run or if he's going to throw. And he's quarterbacking like a squirrel, man. He's all over the place. He's doing many things because he can't make up his mind what he wants to do. He's like a point guard who dribbles down and she's all over the place because she doesn't know if she's going to shoot or if she's going to pass. She doesn't know what she's going to do. That's the picture of Herod. He's doing many things. In his head, he's going this way and that way. He's like, oh, I could go that way, I could go that way. I really need to listen to John. Maybe I should actually live what I've been professing. I don't know, but she's a wily woman. And he doesn't know it. And so he's there in this crossroads place. And he's there because he's bound. He's a captive to his own desires. He likes John. He's warm towards John. He likes the message. He believes he's a righteous man, which means, I think, probably he believes he's also telling the truth when he preaches. But he can't make up his mind what he's going to do because, again, he is bound by his desires, bound, first of all, by his sexual desires. I mean, it's interesting that Herodias, who knows him, sees her chance. He's almost certainly drunk or buzzed. And so she says, here's how we're going to get him to do something. Honey, you go in and you dance sexually. And this is a sexual dance. This isn't the floss. This isn't the Macarena or the hustle. There's probably some twerking involved in this dance. And she's like, you go in and you dance in front of him and he will lose his mind and give you anything you want. So Herodias knows her husband well. And that's the command. Go in there, dance. He's got a problem in this area. And you will turn his buttons, you'll turn his knob. If you will do this, He'll go crazy. He'll give you anything you want. And what it means is that this is something that he's bound by. And he's listening to John preach, and he's like, ah, this sounds right. This sounds good. I think John's telling me the truth. But if John is right, I can't do all this stuff, and I really like all this stuff. I really look down this road, and I like what I see there, and I look down this road, but John is sort of telling me the truth here. And people are in that place today. People come to church, and they're like Herod, and they say, you know, I think he's telling the truth. I think that Bible means what it says, but, you know, if I go down that road, then I can't go down that road, and boy, there's some attractive stuff down that road. The Bible speaks of this sexual desire that we have, and and Herodias would have known, because he played the Jew, and he would have known the Old Testament. He would have known what the Bible says about his bondage to this desire, that first of all, it's not a loving thing. Remember when Joseph was tempted by Potiphar's wife, and she gets him by the cloak, and he says, how can I do this thing to your husband? I can't do this to your husband. Fulfilling sexual desire in a way that God doesn't want you to is ultimately a breaking of the command to love people as, or doing to others as you would want them to do to you. He says, I can't do this thing to your husband. And you say, well, she doesn't have a husband. Well, she's got a father. And she's going to have future husbands. I remember, and I've told this before, being in a youth camp, and the preacher did a low-down, dirty thing, but it was funny at the time. He said, how many of you are dating? And every, you know, lots of couples stood. I didn't have a girlfriend. Thank the Lord I didn't at that time. Didn't often have a girlfriend, and that was sort of the norm. I was single. But a lot of other people stood up, and he said, now, how many of you plan on marrying the person that you're dating? And that's where it got funny, because, this is fun sitting down. And so they look at each other, and a few sit down, and a few, you know, you could tell that was probably the end of that. And it was a youth camp relationship anyway. It wasn't going to last anyway. But ended 2 days early. And so he said, all right, so most of you, you're dating somebody that you really don't plan to marry. Said, so, let me take this little step farther. You're dating somebody who will be married to somebody else. And so somebody else is probably dating somebody who will someday be married to you. So the person that you're dating is going to be somebody else's husband. And your wife is out there dating somebody else now, and someday you'll find each other. So we're back to the great command. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. All right? They're dating your future wife. You're dating their future wife. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I mean, it really is a breaking the command of love, if you think about it that way. And it is a wicked thing, because it's a personal thing against Jesus. I mean, but when Joseph is tempted, he says, how can I do this wicked thing? And he's just not talking about adultery. He's talking about preferring his desire above God's desire for him. I mean, if you are a believer, or you claim to be a believer, and you're in this relationship, and you're having sex with the person you're in a relationship with, but you claim to be a believer, at the very least, you have to admit that the two most important people in your life that you claim are the most important are Jesus and, let's say, your boyfriend. And when your boyfriend and Jesus disagree, you always take your boyfriend's side. That's the very least that is going on there. And that's a very personal thing against Jesus. And maybe you don't feel how personal that is, but maybe someday you will. Maybe someday you'll be married to a man who has a boss and he loves his job, and every time the boss calls and you're together, he answers the phone and he goes off and does what his boss wants him to do. And he leaves you at the dinner. He leaves you at the game. He leaves you. But whenever there's a conflict between you and his boss, the boss always wins. If you're in that situation, I bet it feels personal to you. The two most important people in his life are his wife and his boss, and he always chooses his boss over his wife. It's going to feel very personal to you. And it is very personal when you continue to say that Jesus is Lord and there are these other people and you keep choosing these other people over Jesus. It's not the breaking of a law. It's the breaking of a relationship, and it's personal. And not only is it personal, but it's a sin against you. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 18 says that sexual sin is different than all other sin in that when you do it, you sin against yourself. You're the one getting bit by it. And that's self-evident. Jack Hayford, pastor in California for a very long time, pastor of a very large church, he said at the end of his ministry, he said, I cannot tell you that anyone ever came into my office and said, listen, I want to talk to you about something I'm struggling with in my past. It's under the blood, but I can't move past it. It was never about stealing. It was never about cussing. It was never about anger. It was always about something they did sexually in their past that they couldn't move past, even though they said it was under the blood. It was never any of the other sins. It was always that. When they said, there's something I'm struggling with that I did in my 20s, and I know I'm in my 50s, and God has forgiven me, but I'm just struggling with it. He said, it was always that. It's always that. There's a sinning against yourself. And again, I know it's getting very quiet, and some of you are getting a little mad, and you're sad you came to church, but let me speak to your teenagers, okay? I'm not talking to you. God can redeem, God can forgive, but let me talk to the people who need to hear this for a minute. When you look at the studies that are done, not in Christian organizations, but in secular organizations, and you look at the variables that create divorce, in all the studies I've ever seen, the single greatest determinant of whether a marriage will end in divorce has to do with how many people the people coming into the relationship slept with before they got married. It is the single greatest determinant. And you can talk about why is that, and I think it has a lot to do with trust. I think in some ways that, remember when you were a kid and you get like a sticker and you put on your sweater, but then you really liked the sticker, so you kept putting it on all the other shirts. And if you got it on Monday, by Friday, all the sticky had worn off. That's what the sexual act is in marriage. Sort of sticks you together. I mean, that's why, you know, we talk about having things in common now. You got to have stuff in common. Our great-great-grandparents did not have stuff in common. They stayed married for 60 years, had 15 kids, and they didn't play tennis together or watch TV together. They didn't do anything together. He worked out in the field. She worked in the house. We've all seen Little House on the Prairie. We know how that worked. And, what kept them together? Yeah, they slept together. That's what kept them together. And because the sticky was on the sticker, they stuck. You go out and you wear all the sticky off where the act itself doesn't mean anything to you. You get into a relationship and it's like, I don't know, we don't feel all that close. Maybe we need to join the country club. Maybe we need to golf together. Maybe we need to take a cooking class together. No! You wore the sticky off of the act, man. You got a problem. Now, God can redeem, and God can heal, and God can put the sticky back on your little sticker. But
know how far this analogy can go until I just have to say it. But doesn't mean you're not doing it to yourself. And so here's Herod. And he's got this thing. It's like, I like the women. But I like what John's telling me the truth. But then there's the women. He's standing in the cross. And then there's just not the sexual desire, but there's the peer pressure of the group, because it says that, I guess, when he sobers up or something, or when she comes back and says, I want the head of John the Baptist, it says because of those who were watching him, he wouldn't break the vow. Now, if that had been a normal person, you have to say, oh, I didn't mean that. Didn't mean half the kingdom either. I thought you wanted a pony or something. I'm not giving you that head of the man of God. Put your clothes on. All you jokers, get out of the palace. Party's over. That's what normal person, I think, would do. But he's got all these guys, and he's the king, and it's good to be king. In high school, I wondered, because I was never in the top echelon. I was down there, way down, you know, the ladder. But it was always interesting watching from a distance how all like the top social movers were always intimidated by people down the ladder, or they would always try to show off for them. Let me put it that way. They would always show off for the hanger-ons. Like, why do you show up for it? It was like they were like little Michael Scotts, you know, in the office. And he's the boss, but he's trying to impress all of the lackeys. And here's Herod, and it's like, he's the king. Why doesn't he look at everybody and say, out, clothes on, everybody out. I almost did something really stupid. But he can't do that because culturally, or there's something inside of him. He is dominated by the peers around him. And they have him trapped too. His sexual desire and his desire to look a certain way. He's more interested in looking right than doing right. He's more interested in looking good than doing good. And that's because he is bound by what people think about him. And so here he is again in the crossroads, wondering what he's going to do. And he's a squirrel in the road, man. And because of that, two things happen. First of all, he misses John the Baptist. John could have won him to the Lord. John could have set him right. John could have led him to the one who could have got him free. John could have made him one of the great rulers. But instead, shortly after this happens, he ends up being in exile with Herodias, and he loses his kingdom. John could have made a difference in his life, but he didn't have the courage to do what John told him he ought to do. He missed out on John. And not only did he miss out on John, he missed out on Jesus, because in Luke chapter 20-something another, 22nd, I think. Did I give that to you? It's magic. No, it's not magic. Luke 23. When Pilate heard of Galilee, he hears that Jesus is there before Pilate, and he says, oh, this guy's from Galilee, okay. He asked if the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. Now, when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad. Here he is again. He's happy. Ah, this is going to be great. I love preachers. This guy's going to be great. For he had desired for a long time to see him, because he had heard many things about him, and he hoped to see him, see some miracle done by him. Then he questioned him with many words, but Jesus answered him nothing. I think that's because partially what he did to John, I think it was partially because he wanted Jesus put on a show, and Jesus wasn't a showman. But here he is. He misses out on John, and now here is the Lord Jesus Christ, and Jesus says, Herod, I have nothing to do with you. Nothing to do with you. You have no part of me.
There's no relationship here. I'm not talking to you. I'm not spending my words on you, Herod. So he misses out on John. He misses out on Jesus. And you and I, if we stand in the crossroads too long, we miss out on Jesus. Jesus passes by and we miss out on him because, you know, we love the gospel, or we like the sound of the gospel. We would love to go to bed tonight knowing that if I die, I'd go to heaven. That's great. I'd like to have a good marriage. I'd like to be free from all this. But I like all that, and I like all that, and I like all that. That's Herod. And in many ways, that's 21st century church people. Again, I use this passage quite a lot, and someday you can repeat it to me. It's in Jeremiah chapter 8. The harvest is past. The summer has ended. And we are still not saved. Again, you divide life into four seasons, 0 to 20, 20 to 40, 40 to 60, 60 to 80. If you're past 40, the summer is past. It's over. The leaves are changing or falling off the tree. You're in fall, man. And there are people filling church pews. They're in fall. And they're still spiritual squirrels. They don't know. They might want to divorce their wife after all. They might want to find somebody new. They can't figure out how to get to church more than twice a month. And some of you are here and you say, doggone, I only come once a month and I got to hear this. Well, yeah, you need to hear this. That they can't get their kids in Sunday school. They can't get their kids in any kind of a youth program. I was talking to a guy a little bit ago, and he's in his 40s, and he's leaving his church because he's not getting fed. And I told him in the nicest way, listen, you're in the fall of life. It's not about you anymore. Get your kids in a church. Get them there. You can watch preachers on YouTube and get fed for whatever else it's worth. But you have to live for your kids now. It's about them. Get them where they need to be. You got people in their 40s and 50s, still can't make a commitment, still can't get their finances right, still can't figure out if their children are more important than their musical preferences. Get your kids where they need to be. It's not about you. Quit being a squirrel. And that's Herod. Here he is, man. Here he is. I can't figure out. Middle of the road. John's telling me the truth. He's a holy man. The book is right. But here I am. I'm 45, and I sure like the 25-year-old I'm married to. And I really like her daughter. I mean, nuts. Absolutely nuts. But again, that's a picture of America today. The picture of American churches. Sometimes as a pastor, you feel like you're preaching to a bunch of Herods. Don't even know if they're here. Don't even know if they're going to stay. Monday through Friday, you run the bloody complaint center. And the complaints are coming from people who should know better. Not me, other people. Other pastors. And listen. The time has come for some people to make a decision. To make a decision. How would Kamala say it? The future has to be unhinged from the past or whatever. But the way you've lived isn't how you need to live in the future. Now let me say this. Then I'm finished. My dad died on a Thursday. And on Tuesday, I was sitting at his bed. He died early Thursday morning. Tuesday, I was sitting at his bed, and he knew he didn't have long to live, and the time was very near. Hospice care was working on him. And he referenced that passage. He said, you know, my whole life, here I am, and I still don't know why Jesus let John get his head cut off. And he was talking about his situation, because then he said, I don't know why God heals, and sometimes he seems to abandon. He was talking about this passage. And I've thought about that now for 5 years. Why did John get his head cut off? Why did Jesus let that happen? I'm content that John had to die. I think John was right that he had to decrease and Jesus had to increase. And John was so famous, he had so many followers, that if he had lived, they would have continued to follow John. He would not have decreased. And for Jesus to have his ministry in full, John had to come off the scene. And those disciples had to be transferred to Jesus. And I just don't think it would have happened if John had been in the area, if John had been there. He was too great. It would have been like Joshua trying to lead the children of Israel while Moses was still alive. It just wasn't going to work. I'm content to believe that John had to die. But why did he have to get his head cut off? I mean, in many ways, John was the second coming of Elijah. In fact, Jesus will say in Matthew chapter 11 that for those who are willing to receive it, that John is Elijah. And the parallels between Elijah and John are significant. I mean, it's interesting that John basically gets in trouble because he has a weak king and a mean queen that are out to get him, which is what Elijah had. He had Ahab and Jezebel. John had Herod and Herodias. He had Jezebel, Herodias, sort of the same enemy there. So there are similarities. But see, Elijah got to go to heaven in a chariot. John got his head cut off. And to me, that's like a little better than getting mauled by a grizzly bear. I mean, there's levels of dying here. I don't know why John had to get his head cut off. No. As my dad laid there, there are questions about why weren't all the prayers answered. I don't know why God does what he does. But I know that Jesus loved John. And Jesus called John the greatest man who ever lived. And so everything that happened to John had a reason. It had to. John was too important for this situation not to be orchestrated by God. And John understands it now if he didn't understand then. It was God's will. And I'm glad that John trusted God to the end to bring about that will. So some of you are Herod today in this story. I hope none of you are Herodias. Shame on you. Some of you are Herod. And you need to make a decision what you're going to do with Jesus Christ. Some of you are John, and things are happening in your life that you can't understand, you can't fathom, and you're just going to have to trust God to see you through and to work out his will in your life. I don't know why you're trapped. I don't know why you're in prison. I don't know why the enemies are in. I don't know why you're struggling physically. I don't know why it seems like people are out to get you. I don't know why. But Jesus loves you, and you're going to have to trust him. You're going to have to trust him with your life, with your final breaths, with your current breaths. You're going to have to trust him. Stand with me.